This is The Guardian. Hi, Regid Ahmed here, coming to you from Gadigal land. News is coming thick and fast out of the United States with the increasingly authoritarian actions of Donald Trump. So every Saturday, we're bringing you an episode of our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, so you can stay across all of it. Here's host Jonathan Friedland.
The impact of the Epstein files has shaken politics on both sides of the Atlantic and both parties in the US. While Democrats have been pointing the finger at Donald Trump, for months Republicans have been piling the pressure on Bill and Hillary Clinton.
This morning, House Republicans are moving to hold former President Bill Clinton in contempt of Congress after failing to appear for a closed-door deposition in the investigation into Jeffrey Epstein.
This week, the Clintons finally caved.
The former U.S. President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary, a former Secretary of State, have agreed to testify before the congressional investigation.
But not everyone is happy to see them testify.
I think it's a shame, to be honest. I always liked him. Her, yeah.
So what should we expect from this new testimony? Will Republicans regret forcing the Clintons to give evidence in their Jeffrey Epstein investigation? Is this really the way to stop people talking about something Donald Trump so desperately wants to put behind him? I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly America.
Full Story is supported by Australian Industry Group, Australia's largest and most experienced industry association. From workplace laws to skills shortages and compliance, Australian businesses face challenges every day. Supporting over 60,000 businesses nationwide, Australian Industry Group is Australia's trusted business partner for compliance, advocacy, and growth. Members enjoy the benefits of instant HR and legal advice, along with access to a team of experts in workplace relations, compliance, legal, skills development, apprenticeships, and more. Whether you're shaping strategy, managing people, or driving operations, Australian Industry Group exists to help businesses of all sizes thrive. Learn more and join today at australianindustrygroup.com.au.
I had a similar sort of reaction, which is like the Clintons again.
Ankush Kadoori is a senior writer for Politico magazine, who writes a regular legal column there. In a former life, he was a federal prosecutor in the Department of Justice, leaving that role towards the end of Donald Trump's first term. Ankush, very good to have you back with us on the podcast. I'm revealing something of my age here, but I have to say, when I heard the news that Bill Clinton was going to be testifying about his long past, it brought me right back to the 1990s, depositions, Clinton under oath, etc. I'm sure Bill Clinton himself won't have the fondest memories of that experience.
And yeah, of course, his wife, too, is famously testified before Congress, the Benghazi hearing, the many multi-hour thing. So, yeah, this is sort of not on this subject, but this is a show that we have sort of seen before.
We have, and Bill Clinton there famously testifying as part of the Kenneth Starr inquiry into the Monica Lewinsky affair and the tape of that ran again endlessly in the late 90s. Let's talk about how we got to this new situation. It was on late Monday night, Tuesday morning in the UK, that news broke that both the former president, Bill Clinton, and the former Secretary of State, Democratic presidential nominee, of course, against Donald Trump in 2016, Hillary Clinton, had agreed to be deposed to give evidence at the end of this month. They will be questioned by a Republican-led investigative panel into the crimes of the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Why does that panel want to hear from the Clintons?
You know, so this is a very good question. So the panel, the House Oversight Panel, is sort of an interesting body at the moment because the investigation began under James Comer, a Republican who is the chair. And it was kind of initiated in an effort to kind of help the Trump administration out. And, you know, when he began his investigation on Epstein material, he focused on not people in the Trump administration. He was focused on people like Clinton.
And then we know that Bill Clinton flew on Epstein's plane somewhere around 27 times after the presidency. So no one's accusing Bill Clinton of any wrongdoing. We just have questions. And that's why the Democrats voted along with Republicans to subpoena Bill Clinton.
So the origins of the House Oversight Committee's work are like a little complicated in this context. But the answer to your question about Clinton is it's Republicans who want to talk to him.
And is that because they think he's genuinely got something to say, or they want the political theater of a Democratic president and former presidential nominee under scrutiny, as if to level the playing field and say, yeah, there's questions about Trump, but there's also questions about the Clintons. There's a plague on all houses. Don't make this a Republican weakness.
It is definitely the latter. It is definitely the latter. And I will say I've heard from people, like even when I do appearances, people calling in, Republicans saying, well, why are you so concerned about Trump? Why aren't you focused on the Clintons? And I'm like, Clinton is not the sitting president. He has not been in office for 25 years. Trump is the sitting president. There are all these questions swirling around. So this is not an earnest effort to like explore the crimes of Jeffrey Epstein. It's sort of an awkward effort to sort of run interference for the White House. So no, I don't expect this to be a productive or particularly informative exercise.
So in terms of the substance, because I'm going to have to ask about something once they've got the actual, you know, shot, the spectacle of him on the stand, them on the stand. We know it's been quite well documented that Bill Clinton did have an association, some kind of friendship with Epstein about a quarter of a century ago, late 90s, early 2000s.
Also in the new release, a rare photo of Bill Clinton, pictured here alongside Epstein and his convicted associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, what appears to be Clinton's signature right in the center.
He hasn't been accused of any wrongdoing in any of his interactions with Epstein, but people do talk about it, and there are photographs and so on. But why the interest in Hillary Clinton? What could she possibly have to do with Epstein, the Epstein world? How does she fit in?
I am not sure that she does. Right? It's a very good question. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, like Republicans really do not like Hillary Clinton, particularly the class of politicians who are currently in power in the Republican Party. Hillary Clinton is like this object of derision. I think even more so than Bill Clinton at this point, quite honestly, particularly given her run against Trump in 2016 and how all that went down. So, but there's been no indication from anything I've seen that she had anything to do with Epstein or knew much of anything at all, right? Whereas with Clinton, you're right. There are photos, there's documentation, there's at least some nominal predicate for wanting to understand his relationship with Epstein a little bit more. Hillary Clinton, I think this is a spectacle. I mean, this is not an earnest effort to investigate anything.
And it's been noticeable that she is still sort of in the fight and does talk about Donald Trump and makes a public appearance and so on, where Bill Clinton's interventions are fewer and rarer. The back and forth and sort of haggling about this appearance has been going on actually since last August, with for a long time the Clintons refusing to testify in front of this panel. You know, you may have answered it by saying it's not a good faith effort, but why were the Clintons so reluctant to appear before this congressional body?
So one thing I should not sort of totally dismiss out of hand is that I'm sure personal embarrassment on the part of Bill Clinton and perhaps even relatedly Hillary Clinton, she's been embarrassed for decades over her husband's behavior, right, is probably influencing how they've approached this, right? Of course, you know, this body, Comer, the Republican leading this body, they haven't asked to speak to Trump. They don't care. Comer has specifically said, like, we see no reason to speak to Trump. So, like, you put those two things together, and this is not serious.
And we should make clear that, I mean, first of all, you mentioned about Trump not being brought there. He's mentioned in more than 5,000 different files. It's thought that he and his associates are mentioned one way or another 38,000 times in the cache of documents that came out just last week. So there would be, if you were doing a good faith investigation, plenty of reasons why you might want to talk to Donald Trump. But just on the Clintons, we should ought to make clear that it's not as if they have always been refusing to speak at all. Reportedly, the couple had actually offered to provide evidence in a more limited way, whether it was a transcribed interview in Bill Clinton's case or submitting a sworn declaration in Hillary Clinton's case. That, I think, wasn't enough for the committee. But I'm interested in this. It wasn't just Republicans who wanted to see, if necessary, punishment of the Clintons if they refused to testify. Nine of the committee's Democrats joined Republicans in support of the charges against Bill Clinton, and three Democrats actually supported the threat of charges against Hillary Clinton. That puzzles me a bit. Why do you think those people went along with this? If it was just a partisan, seeking a partisan advantage and a spectacle, why would Democrats go along with that on that committee?
I think there's at least one reason, which some of them have alluded to in public, which is that this will set a precedent they believe that would allow them to subpoena Trump in the future, right? Let's have sitting or maybe even another former president in the future. I don't find that to be particularly compelling rationale strategically, but they may turn out to be right. I don't know. But that is one rationale.
Because Donald Trump always obeys precedent and norms, as we know.
This is my problem. It's like, okay, the fact that it will do probably nothing to impose any additional pressure on Trump to have the Clintons testify.
Yeah. So, as we said, the Clintons initially were trying to negotiate a different kind of compromise. They did finally make a concession this week that has led to this date being set for towards the end of this month. What's your read of what made them make that move and finally bow to this request?
I do think the vote that you refer to seems to have mattered to them, right? It is still the case that they occupy sort of, you know, rarefied space in the party, for better or worse, right? Former president, a former presidential candidate, secretary of state, right? You know, well-regarded in the party despite their personal sort of challenges over the years. And by the way, I don't think this Justice Department would hesitate at all to prosecute them for contempt of Congress. So I do think this was a real threat, even though this Justice Department absolutely picks and chooses who it wants to prosecute. That's exactly the problem in this context, is that I think the Justice Department would have been more than happy to run with a criminal referral and prosecute one or both of them for contempt of Congress.
And contempt of Congress, we should be clear, isn't just some sort of political procedural thing. It could lead to jail.
That is correct, right? And this story has become so crazily layered. Recall that, you know, Trump has had some of his own advisors go to prison for contempt of Congress, including Peter Navarro, who's currently serving in the White House. He went to prison for a little while under the last administration because he would refuse to comply with the subpoena from the January 6th committee. So there is also an element here, sort of unstated, of like politicians getting back at each other, partisans getting back at each other, trying to use, you know, you did this to us, we're going to do it to you. I think there's an element of kind of cuteness to it too, which is like, oh, well, you guys thought you had us with contempt of Congress. Now the shoe's on the other foot. We can prosecute you for contempt of Congress. So I think that's quite a bit what's going on here. It's sad to say, because none of these are good reasons for the government to be spending its time on this. None of them.
Yeah, and that notion of the sort of tit for tat cycle you can get into was one reason why people did try and restrain their use of these weapons and sort of subscribe to various norms of restraint before, because they knew once you do it, then they'll do it, then you'll do it, and back and forth. The testimonies, when they happen, will be done behind closed doors. They will be filmed. There'll be transcripts. It does seem as if the Clintons, you know, their hand was forced into this. It's not something they wanted. But nevertheless, it does also seem as if they think there is something they can get out of it, and they want to make sure they do. They have said that they want their depositions, their evidence to be made public in their entirety. That's something that Comer, the chairman you refer to, didn't acknowledge fully in his response. I'm just curious what opportunity there is there that the Clintons are spotting that makes them think, yeah, if we're going to do this, we want it all out there. We want to make sure the public see everything. Why would the Clintons want it, and why would Republicans not want that?
It's possible they see it as an opportunity. I think for sure they want to prevent something from happening, which is for the deposition to take place behind closed doors and for selective leaks to come out of it, incomplete leaks, particularly on the part of Republicans. Some version of this actually happened sort of recently already, where Jack Smith, the special counsel who prosecuted Trump, had appeared before Congress. He initially, too, had a version of this where they asked him to come in. He said, I want to do it publicly, in part because he didn't want selective leaks. He then does come in. They record it all, transcribe it. They hold on to it for a bit. They dump it on New Year's Eve because it did not go well for Republicans. And eventually he did come and testify before Congress at the request of Republicans. And, you know, that was, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. So we have actually seen this dynamic already play out in this context. Like, there is a concern that Republicans in these contexts, and it's, you know, the concerns are will go the other way when Democrats control these bodies, that there will be selective leaks and that there will not be a complete and fair readout of the testimony unless it's recorded and put out in its entirety.
Yeah, so it's a preventative, prophylactic measure on their part. We get that. I'm interested to know what your expectation is. What do you expect to hear and read in these testimonies? Do you think the Clintons are at any criminal risk? And I suppose, is the incentive a little bit for Bill Clinton to hope that, given that it's become, you know, the photos are shown again and again of him, Bill Clinton and Jeffrey Epstein, that maybe he can at last draw a line under this and say, you now know everything, and then that's that.
He might, right? I mean, look, we don't see that much of Clinton Bill Clinton in public life anymore. But, you know, he has remained throughout the years one of the more eloquent or articulate and nimble Democratic politicians who, in these settings, tends to overperform. That's true of Hillary Clinton, too, right, with the Benghazi hearing, which was supposed to be like an epic debacle for her, and she emerged quite well through many, many hours of questioning. So there is a possibility that he could see this as a way to put a line under it, as another reason to do this. In terms of what I'm expecting to find out, honestly, look, I'm sure the Republicans would love to do two things. One, make Clinton appear to be very close to Epstein, and part of that is Clinton's own fault, right? So I don't want to be dismissive of that, right? But also, two, to your point, there may be some effort to insinuate that Clinton knew about Epstein's ongoing crimes. Now, of course, everybody knew about the conviction, but what is of concern is, like, what did people know about the child sex trafficking abuse that postdated the conviction for many years? Now, there is no evidence of this yet. We need to be very clear about this. So this could get ugly nonetheless. And I would say more generally, look, to some extent, I'm not a great person to answer this question because I opposed this whole exercise of, like, releasing the Epstein files and excavating all this stuff. I did not think it would be a good or productive use of the country's time or resources. And I think that's all being proven in real time. Quite honestly, this document dump has been unhelpful, I think, in the main. But I think the one thing we can say indisputably about the documents that have been released so far is that they do not reveal any additional criminal conduct on the part of the rich and powerful people that Congressman Ro Khanna and Congressman Thomas Massie promised they would reveal once the documents came to light. And we're in the middle of, like, kind of a slow motion debacle, as I'm sure you're hearing on, you know, in your news media as well. The victims are objecting. The victims are upset. It's been a bit of a mess.
And just from the point of view of the victims and survivors, they would surely say, first, they really wanted this disclosure. I take your point about it as a use of energy and time, but they wanted it. But also, surely some would say, that's because we haven't had all of them released yet. There are still millions more unreleased, and maybe the criminal misconduct that was billed would be revealed in the documents that have not yet been brought to light.
I think that second point is important, right? This is still an ongoing exercise. So that is an important caveat. The Democrats have already begun efforts to kind of review the unredacted files. The Justice Department said they will accommodate that request. So I assume at some point that will happen and we will get some sort of readout, formal or informal. Maybe that will dramatically change the complexion. I doubt it. Here's why. Hundreds of career prosecutors were reviewing this material. And the career prosecutors are not happy about leadership at this Justice Department. I think if some of them had come across really damning material about sort of other people, we will start to hear about that through leaks. But I do want to, if I could, come back to the first point you raised, which is about what the victims wanted here. Because I think this is a point that many people make, and I actually have a very sharply different view on this. If Congress wanted to take this as seriously as they claimed, we should not have gotten a document dump of millions of documents and pages that will just allow everyone to go rummage forever and generate their own new conspiracy theories and weaponize. They should have set up an Epstein commission where Congress puts some real thought. They get some respectable people at the helm. They give them a mandate about what they want them to investigate and some staff and some resources. That is how Congress used to do things that matter to them. This was really aggravating because this is a totally false dichotomy that the sponsors of the bill have been proffering for months. And they have claimed to me even publicly that if you criticize them, you are on the side of protecting child sex traffickers. This is a toxic political and social environment. It has all the markers, quite honestly, of a moral panic, right? So we have to be careful in this moment. And the last thing I would say about the victims, of course, I think they've been horribly mistreated by our politicians. Like I said, they did not take this as seriously as they claim to take it.
Yeah, and the notion of an indiscriminate dump of documents rather than a commission of inquiry is a point well taken. After the break, Ankush and I discuss why the Epstein investigation might never actually be over, despite what Donald Trump might want. We'll be right back. We're back with Ankush Kadoori. Not all Republicans, Ankush, are happy about this focus on the Clintons. Perhaps very unexpectedly, one person who has voiced his discontent is Donald Trump himself.
It bothers me that somebody's going after Bill Clinton. See, I like Bill Clinton. I still like Bill Clinton.
What do you like about him?
I liked his behavior toward me. I thought he got me. He understood me. You know, he was the
one who said a couple of times that he likes Bill Clinton, and as if he wouldn't have gone down this road. Can you explain that for us?
Well, look, Donald Trump is all over the place at any given moment, right? He hates the Clintons, he likes them, whatever. For sure, Trump wants this to be over. Trump has always wanted this to be over since coming back into office, right? The reason why we're in this situation is because of the promises he made and his senior officials made over the years. Then they came in and tried to shut it down very quickly and tell everyone sort of move along, nothing to see here. That created this whole firestorm. So no doubt, Trump has wanted to move on from this for quite some time because the revelations are not good for him, right? Now, there's no evidence of criminal misconduct. Let me be very clear about that. But like the Clintons or anyone of these rich and powerful people, this is embarrassing for him. And he has not, despite the administration's claims, Trump has never managed to give a clean account and timeline of his actual relationship with Epstein and the rupture, despite the administration's claim. That has never emerged. So for sure, Trump wants this to be over. I think you're right. It's probably never going to end because the nature of a conspiracy theory, as you know, is there's always another thread to pull.
Yeah, the comparison I've been making on the podcast is with the Kennedy assassination, that this can go for decades and decades because people will always find a new question to ask. I want to get your reading of one line that leapt out at me from the Clinton's lawyer's letter to this congressional committee. The lawyer said, they look forward to setting a precedent that applies to everyone. Now, that is spelled out very deliberately. It's not there by accident. I think you may have hinted at this, but who might they have in mind with that line?
Trump, right? Trump.
I'm wondering whether all of this leads you to have some sympathy for Donald Trump himself when he said on Tuesday he thinks the country should move on from this story. He did it while scolding Caitlin Collins, White House correspondent for CNN.
I think it's really time for the country to get onto something else, really. And now that nothing came out about me, other than it was a conspiracy against me, literally, by Epstein and other people. Yeah, what did you say?
What would you say to the survivors who feel that they haven't gotten justice?
You are the worst reporter. No wonder CNN has no ratings because of people like you. You know, she's a young woman. I don't think I've ever seen you smile. I've known you for 10 years. I don't think I've ever seen a smile.
Well, I'm asking you about survivors of Jeffrey Epstein.
You know why you're not smiling? Because you know you're not telling the truth.
Trump thinks the country should move on. Do you think they should, and do you think they will?
Yes, I think the country should move on. I do not think that they will. Like I said, I kind of think this is now a permanent component of our politics, akin to the sort of the JFK thing. I think it's probably never going away. Am I sympathetic to Trump in that respect? No. Even though I agree we should move on, I'm not sympathetic to him at all. They created this mess. It was Trump who said on the campaign trail in a response to Fox News that he would release these files. It was J.D. Vance, his vice president, who laughed about this and said, we need to get the client list out concerning Epstein. It was Kash Patel, his FBI director. It was Dan Bongino, until recently his deputy FBI director, who were the people spitting this up for years. So no, Trump deserves no sympathy in this context. He created this mess. His allies created this mess. If he had any sense of decency, these people like Kash Patel would not be in power anymore. And last summer, Kash Patel, when he joined this, you know, signed off on this memo saying there's nothing else to see here, basically debunked himself. I mean, this is how preposterous this situation is. He's like, oh, there's nothing to see here. And he's hoping everyone can move on. And it's like, okay, would you like to account for your years of comments on the subject then?
I mean, Donald Trump himself is trying to flip this round. For a long time, as you said, on the campaign trail, he certainly appeared to endorse those who believed that there has a conspiracy, that Washington was run by a secretive cabal of pedophiles. He played into that. Now he says that there is a conspiracy, but it's being waged against him by Epstein and other people. Do you think his base will buy that kind of attempt to flip the tables?
First of all, he's always the victim, right? He's always the victim in everything, even when he's the wrongdoer. Do I think his base? That's an interesting question. I mean, look, his base has somewhat fractured over this a little bit. Now, I don't know how serious a rupture that will prove to be politically over the long term, but it is the case that a certain component of these people, including sort of prominent right-wing commentators, feel like they've been misled and betrayed. Now, the problem is that for many years, there have been versions of this happening, and these people always come home to Trump. Now, Trump will no longer be on the ballot, so of course, you know, there's not a one-to-one comparison here, but like, is this a permanent fissure within this movement? There are other things that, you know, are occurring at the same time here that are going to complicate the ongoing durability of this coalition anyway, including that Trump will not be on a ballot again.
Ankush, as you know, because you've been with us before, we do always like to ask a what else question, something different from what the topic has been until now. And I want to ask you about some comments Donald Trump made this week about voting.
We want to take over. We should take over the voting in at least many, 15 places. The Republicans ought to nationalize the voting.
Republicans can't actually nationalize elections and take control of the voting, as Donald Trump suggested, can they?
No, they cannot. This is yet another disturbing idea that Trump has thrown out there. I hope it does not get any traction, but you never know with this Republican Congress. They've been very, very pliant. So this is something that, you know, could be a thing. And I hope not.
Yeah, I mean, the suggestion was that there's too much voting going on that we're not controlling, he seemed to be saying, and we need to get our grips on it, on polling and ballot counting and so on, which did suggest, because obviously elections in the United States are run at state level, people were thought, well, what is he up to now, especially relevant with midterm elections coming up towards the end of the year. Ankush Khadori, thank you so much for joining me on Politics Weekly America.
Thanks for having me.
And that is all from me for this week on Thursday's episode of our sister podcast, Today in Focus. Annie Kelly speaks to Epstein survivor Lisa Phillips, as well as to the columnist Moira Donegan about why survivors are calling for more transparency from the Trump administration. And Friday's episode of The Guardian's audio long read is all about Donald Trump's assault on the Smithsonian Museum. Now, the apparent goal is to reframe American culture and history in his image. So just search for both of those wherever you listen to your podcasts. And lastly, friend of this podcast, Rachel Leingang, has written a great piece about what it's like to live and work in Minneapolis as ICE still roam the streets there. There'll be a link to that in today's show notes. But for now, it's goodbye. The producer is Tom Glasser, the executive producer, Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Thanks, as always, for listening.
This is The Guardian.